Hi, this is Sarah Wildman. I'm sitting in for Sarah Posner on The Posner Show, and I'm here with Mark Tracy of Tablet Magazine, who's also the editor of the forthcoming book, Jewish Jocks, coming out, I think, this November, am I right? With
October, November. It's, I mean, they say the dates one time, the book comes out a different... Yeah, October, November, yeah.
With Frank Foer, right? You're editing with Frank Foer, and it'll be a series of essays about Jewish athletes across history and modern and 20th century, is it?
Mostly modern. I guess the earliest guy we have is Dan Mendoza, the legendary 18th century English boxer. So, I mean, minus a few references here and there to the Bible and to what the Talmud has to say about sports, yeah, basically starts in 18th century, and it's mostly a 20th century thing.
Great. So, well, given that, we have a couple of big subjects to cover in a very short amount of time. One is the decision of the IOC not to honor the Munich 11 on the 40th anniversary of the massacre of Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics in 1972. Then I was hoping we'd look at the two 15 years apart covers of Bibi Netanyahu by Time Magazine, both asking, can he make peace? And then if we can kind of wrap up with the Jewish vote. Small subjects that are all in and of themselves book-length worthy. But let's start with Munich since, you know, we're focused on athletes. And talk a little bit about why, you know, I was thinking about this last night after we mentioned it. And, I was struck by the fact that, you know, in 2010, when the Georgian luger was killed in the practice runs, there was a moment of silence for him at the beginning of the games. I don't know if you remember that. And, but of course, the IOC has always been very, very, very nervous about anything that smacks of a political ideology. And the question is, of course, is this about politics? Is this about what this, you know, the spirit of the Olympic Games are? And, you know, if you look to, I was, you know, reading backwards, I was reading about various athletes, and I saw that Anouk, who is the daughter of the fencing coach, had come to the States and to the Atlanta Olympics in 1996,
right,
like the 24th anniversary, because apparently she'd received promises at the time that there would be an honoring at that point, and then it didn't happen. And at the same year, when there was the Atlanta bombing, the IOC also refused to acknowledge that that there was a woman killed during the Atlanta bombing, and they did not acknowledge her either. You know, they're very nervous. But
I think what he did do, Samaranch, who was then the president of the IOC, I think he did discuss Bosnia in his opening remarks, which was a rare, you know, divergence from what the IOC does, which is to say apolitical.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I think that there's I did not realize that, and I think that actually speaks to the greater point. Maybe we can get into this, which is, you know, is this, you know, a sort of statement on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is, I think, how the IOC sees it, or is it about what the Olympic Games are meant to be? You know, what is it? You know, it obviously seems to be, and I hate to use the word singular event, given, you know, Jews and the Holocaust, but, you know, the murder of 11 athletes at the Olympic Village itself in the middle of the Games does seem to be singular. I mean, I don't know how else to characterize it. And it obviously, you know, put this, you know, tremendous strain on both the Germans at the time and on the idea of celebrating the Games. And, of course, it unfolded, you know, as one of the first, you know, truly televised horrific events. I'm sure you've seen the films around it. And, you know, I guess the question is, does this cast a shadow 40 years on that it's never been really acknowledged? It's never been handled by the Olympic Committee. Is this, you know, is there any way to get outside of whatever they think the statement would be? And, you know, why are we handling it this way?
I mean, I certainly think the IOC would say that it's completely to do with the Olympics, you know, founded in 1896 to promote peace. You know, it's going back to the legends of, you know, back, I mean, not legends, I mean, I think it's actually a historical fact that the Greek Olympics, the ancient Greek Olympics, when they would be held, wars would cease briefly, and, you know, there'd be peace, and the IOC would say, you know, we're apolitical, you know, we're devoted to advancing world peace through the cause of sport, et cetera, et cetera. When the Olympics have become politicized, you know, the dueling boycotts with the Soviets and the U.S. in the early 80s, you know, that's been not the IOC doing it, that's been countries doing it. So I think the IOC, I guess they're being fairly consistent. The argument you'd make as to why they should still do it is that it's not really, I mean, I guess it is political, but there's an aspect to it which is not political. I mean, 11 people died, and actually more than that died. A German police officer died. Which, that, I don't see why that shouldn't count. I think 5 terrorists died. Maybe that's not quite what we'd be mourning, but so it's, you know, it's 11 athletes who came there in the spirit of peace and whatnot, who were murdered, and it was a horrific event. And I mean, it becomes politicized because, of course, the person, the people to ask for it is Israel, and actually, it's spearheaded by Danny Aiello, who is an unusually polarizing figure, even by Israeli government standards. Especially, you know, in a place like Europe, but even really anywhere. So it certainly becomes a political event. What will be interesting to see is if other countries join Israel's call, which I think they should, because, as I say, I don't think it's just an Israeli tragedy. I wrote a blog post last week showing where all the different Israeli athletes were born, and they were born in half a dozen different countries, including the United States. One of them was from Cleveland. And a couple New York congressmen have already introduced a House resolution to, you know, call for the same thing that Israel's called for, which is a minute of silence. I doubt the IOC will back down, but we'll see, I guess.
I mean, of course, you know, every time the Israeli team leaves for the Olympics, they do some sort of memorial small ceremony, I think, for them since this has happened. Look, I think that this isn't – you're right. I don't think the IOC will back down. I mean, it's not in their best interest. In their minds, I'm sure that there's a, you know, slippery slope between this and, you know, protests for Tibet in the middle of the Olympics. I mean, I think they see it as along that continuum. And at the time, I think there were 10 or 11 Arab countries that – you know, there was some talk very early on about some sort of commemoration. I think it was, you know, remember, Munich continued, and that was very controversial at the time. And and I think there was only like 10 or 11 Arab countries that asked for, you know, no, I don't know if it was no recognition, but no major statement and no ending or no, you know, commentary on this, which, of course, you know, was obviously particularly egregious in the moment. I think it is interesting that, you know, the widows who've championed this minute of silence, and they've been doing so for a really long time. I mean, now we're saying the 40th, but they've been doing it for a couple of decades, you know, believe that the idea of a minute of silence is not political. And the question is, of course, at this point or if ever, if there ever was a moment when you can discuss, you know, death between murder, you know, murders of Israelis that is not political in some way. And of course it is. And I think it is interesting to me that, you know, as you said, that a number of them were born in different countries. And it's really, they were this representation of the scattering. I mean, there was a Warsaw Ghetto Uprising fighter who was a wrestling coach. And as you said, someone from Cleveland, and
there was a Libyan,
and a Dutch fencer. I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, it was an interesting thing. And there was a story of one of them having approached the Lebanese team purposefully to, you know, show that the spirit of the Olympic Games was about camaraderie and friendship, and that it was about, you know, above all political conflicts. And then, of course, this happened anyway. I don't know. There's something to me very – very, very, very sad about the idea that the conflict is so intractable and so insurmountable that we can't even acknowledge that the, you know, spirit of the Olympic Games was abrogated with these murders. And, you know, obviously it was like the worst, you know, kind of nexus of German post Holocaust anti-militarianism, you know, and, you know, the pre-security and the idea that this sort of thing could happen hadn't really crossed the minds of the Olympic Committee. Obviously now the security is totally...
Well, and I mean, it's interesting because actually the group that perpetrated this, that murdered the 11 Israeli athletes, was actually associated with Fatah, I believe, which is now, obviously, you know, the more moderate Palestinian faction disavows violence in terms of as a mode of resistance to Israel. And so you could sort of imagine a sort of really magnanimous statement, maybe from, I don't even know who, I guess from Abu Mazen, who is the, I guess, the head of Fatah, saying, you know, like, we did this 40 years ago, we don't do this sort of thing anymore, we regret that it happened. You know, you could do the same, but the problem with that is then there would be, there's no reason for him to do that. There's no political reason for him to do that, and plenty of political costs, probably, to him doing that. But in terms of the intractability of the conflict, I mean, I guess that shows it, that the group that formerly was this, you know, terrorist outfit that did this thing now arguably isn't anymore, has evolved to where we want them to go, and yet they can't be the ones anyway to sort of, and they would be the only ones who could, you know, they can't be the ones to, you know, sort of condone some sort of minute of silence type of thing. Right. I mean, Israel asks for it, you know, well, of course Israel asks for it. But if Fatah said they were okay with that, that might be a little different. But, I mean, again, I don't see that happening because what's in it for them?
Right. Abu Mazen, I feel like he's already so caught. He's so hamstrung between the increasingly understandably restive population, you know, which feels completely thwarted by the process, and the fact that he doesn't feel like he has all that much political agency. I mean, you know, it's funny. I mean, I wonder if pre-Palestine papers, maybe you could have seen something, but now that you see how much was offered and how much hasn't progressed, which maybe we should, you know, use this as a segue into Netanyahu and his 15-year differences between the Time magazine covers.
Trajectory?
Around the quest for trajectory, good.
I guess you can't see me, but I air quoted trajectory.
Yeah. trajectory is an interesting, and it's interesting, of course, if you think about it, 1996 when Netanyahu was elected on a super slim margin after a series of horrific suicide bombings which killed, at the moment when he was elected, 59 men, women, and children, and he came in surprising everyone, surmounting Peres by, you know, a very, very small percentage point. And at the time, I actually think that first Time piece is a little more in-depth and nuanced than the second. The second one seems much more in awe of him and is much more of a scene piece. And the first one really lays out this what we now know, looking back, was this kind of nexus moment between the really what was the symbol of the end of Oslo, much more so than anything else, and now. And, you know, even in that piece, they say Netanyahu, you know, pays lip service to the peace process, but in fact, people suspect that he's not going to do much. And the settlement movement, you know, crowed, oh, there'll be 500,000 settlers in 10 years. And they weren't exactly right, but in fact, not that far off. So Let's look at that. Does Bibi want?
Well, it's funny because I was mocking trajectory, but technically there is trajectory. You know, in that piece, you have him saying there is no chance I would allow a Palestinian state. You know, the most I'll go is, I think they use a phrase like generous autonomy. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, as of 2009, at least publicly, Netanyahu is ostensibly rhetorically committed to a Palestinian state, but the question is, how committed is he actually? Is he any more committed than he was 15 years ago? And I guess that's the question that sort of the two timepieces sort of bracket and frame.
Right. I mean, I think what's interesting, too, is, of course, Netanyahu now feels far, far more powerful than he did then. And the facts on the ground have shifted. I think there's an interesting other piece to it, and we can kind of look at this around, you know, the rhetoric that he's used now. I think it was interesting also is that the second piece is really much more focused on Iran. And obviously Iran was still an issue in 1996 as well, or not still, was also an issue in 1996. But the bigger question was the Palestinian relationship, the peace process. And Netanyahu has really successfully maneuvered that conversation away from the Palestinians. We now talk, you know, the conversation is much, much, much more about the Iranian bombing threat and whether or not Israel will bomb Iran. then whether or not the settlement movement will be changed. Will the settlements stop growing? Will they, you know, will they dismantle settlements? I feel like that has really fallen down on the list of conversation topics between Netanyahu and the world and Netanyahu and the United States than it was in 96, where it felt like, oh, here we were at this moment. Rabin had been assassinated. Rabin looked like he was about to, you know, really finally create final status agreement. And it was, the conversation was all about the Palestinians. Oh, and by the way, we're concerned about Iran as well because, you know, they've kind of made noises about bombing Israel. Now we've flipped that. And the question is now, you know, can the Palestinians ever regain ground? And, the sort of Holocaust-based rhetoric of Netanyahu has ramped up as one of them. I think it was the first piece that talked a lot about his father's, kind of endless idea that the Jews are in a sort of, you know, not never-ending Holocaust play in some respects.
Yeah.
I remember.
I've been surprised by how little, maybe just because it's so obvious, but in actually when the new National Unity Coalition happened, a week or two ago, which is what the time piece is pegged to, Netanyahu, at the 11th hour, right before calling for snap elections, in fact, got the largest party in the Knesset, the Kadima Party, to join his coalition. I've been surprised how little mention there has been of the fact that Benzia Netanyahu, his father, had died, 9 days before or something like that, because you really can't understand. I mean, if there's any politician right now where armchair psychology seems actually to pay dividends, it's Bibi, because his father, was one of the founders of Israel, of revisionist Zionism, which is the thread out of which, what we would now call right-wing Zionism comes out of. I actually thought the original timepiece, I reread it last night, the 1996 timepiece, was a little unfair to Benzia Netanyahu, not in terms of, qualifying him as believing that all Jews in all places are always under threat of annihilation. He did believe that, and that's a fair thing. But actually, it stems from his research into the history of the Spanish Inquisition, which was revisionist history. Which actually, I'm not a scholar of it, but my understanding is that his revisionist history of the Spanish Inquisition is correct, and that during the Spanish Inquisition, it was lots of Jews who had converted, who were practicing Catholics, who were still killed.
Right.
Which is interesting, but right. I mean, I think in terms of, to go back to what you said about switching the conversation from Iran to the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly till November, I can't imagine anything significant happening on the Palestinian front. It's just, I can't imagine it because, the U.S. administration, which is crucial to that happening, is not going to be engaged in it. Bibi has successfully changed the conversation, and in terms of Palestinians gaining the initiative, I'm not sure exactly what it'll take. It will certainly probably require some sort of ratcheting down of Iran as well as Syria. Do you think the Palestinians have any sort of way to force the issue, even in the midst of the uncertainty over Iran?
No, I don't. I mean, and I also think that the problem is that, the American election cycle means that nobody wants to kind of progress and have things fail again. I mean, obviously this is one of the questions, and maybe this is part of the reason why these things are hard to tease apart as separate issues, but, Obama came in with pretty strong rhetoric around Bibi and strong rhetoric around settlements, and then, there was this massively staged moment between Secretary Hillary Clinton and the Palestinians and Israelis, and of course those talks went nowhere, and I think that kind of visual failure, even though it was really more about stasis and non-progress, even as much as it was about failure, is not something the Obama administration can have have happen in the middle of an election cycle, and obviously that's not great for the Palestinians, and that's not great for advancing this conversation. I did a piece a couple of weeks or months ago around the idea of territorial concessions, and a lot of the territorial access activists rather on the ground in Jerusalem are afraid that if the Americans are in charge of the process and they need to wait until the beginning of 2013, then in fact there will be no territory left to concede because the settlements are growing quite rapidly at this point, and not about new settlements. It's just about the growth of the settlements that exist, and that they're cutting off kind of land access, and so creating cantons, you know, a sort of northern West Bank and a southern West Bank, and that the access will be about access roads as opposed to a contiguous piece of land. And so the problem is that obviously facts on the ground are continuing to shift in the direction of, you know, a much more difficult peace process. They just are. And yet the Americans, who are, you know, seen still as major brokers or necessary brokers, are not in any position to move forward. Whereas the Iran question feels like a geopolitical conversation that everyone needs to have. And so it's easier to, in some degree, to talk about that. I mean, the Palestinians, unfortunately, for them, and I mean, and for the process, I mean, are always sort of the ones that can wait. I mean, it's not as.
I mean, for 40 years, they've been the ones that can wait.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I think that I don't mean to sound, I don't mean to sound blithe. I mean, it's basically the case. It's not a pressing, you know, kind of security risk to the United States. It's not a pressing. It's not. And at this point, because of the wall and the way that the security has cracked down, and clamped down on life in the West Bank, it's not as pressing a security risk for Israel either. I mean,
as Time Magazine put it on their cover about 18 months ago, why Israel doesn't care about peace, which was, you know, a much maligned cover, but, you know, a piece that actually made the fair point, which is obviously Israel's don't literally not care about peace. Most of them have children in the army, mm-hmm. but at the same time, if you live in Tel Aviv, you know, you have the barrier, you have an occupation that's heavily subsidized by America, by the European Union, et cetera, et cetera. You have a booming economy, you have, you know, give or take a democracy, a vibrant democracy within certainly Israel, and so you go about making a peaceful life for yourself, as any of us would. And so for ordinary Israelis, there's really not a gigantic, at least immediate incentive or imperative to demand that the government make moves on the Palestinian process of its own volition. When they protested in the streets last summer, they weren't protesting over the Palestinians, they were protesting over the cost of housing. And I mean, right. that's their right. I mean, that's what citizens are entitled to do. I don't know that Americans would be any different. And so I just don't, I mean, the Palestinian question right now is just, but I agree with what you're saying in terms of, especially in terms of construction that takes place, you know, not in those, you know, not in, so there's the settlements that everyone sort of generally acknowledges are going to be inside whatever Israel proper emerges after a hypothetical future two-state solution. And then there are the other ones. I think you're talking about the other ones, which are even beyond, which if they keep building, are just going to make the possibility. I mean, a Palestinian state isn't merely about acreage. It's about contiguity, I guess, as you would put it.
Right.
Yeah. And you're saying that even in a year's time, significant damage can be done?
Well, that, I mean, yeah, Danny Seidman, who's one of the big territorial activists on the ground, says that basically that this year is a crucial year. I mean, this is according to his numbers, and, you know, I've certainly had people say to me, well, you know, maybe that's extreme. But, I mean, his numbers, and he seems very sober to me, to be quite honest, and of course he is on the side of peace and he is considered left. But, you know, if you just look at the maps, that the problem is that we've reached a point where it's only a matter of a few kilometers that create a contiguous Palestinian state versus a Palestinian state that is separated by sort of land bridges, or, you know, roads that kind of circumvent, you know, between sections, and that it'll basically we'll see something where those land bridges themselves are swallowed up, that they basically have until, you know, into 2013, but the problem is that the building process and what it means to stall them, and it's not, I think that this actually gets back to this question of Bibi of 96 versus Bibi of 2012, and, you know, in 1996, Israelis had felt much, much closer as a whole. I mean, as you're saying, you know, Tel Avivians now don't feel that they are that close to a burning need for peace, because it to some degree they live in peace, right? I mean, it's like a taxi driver said to me, taxi driver journalism is crap, but you know what I mean.
They live in more peace than residents of most countries in the world, put it that way, you know.
Well, no, of course, and my friends in Tel Aviv, I have family there, and, you know, they say, well, we just want to live in quiet, you know, we want to be able to do the things we want to do, we don't want to have to worry. I mean, and the fact was that for a while, and this is the thing when I talk to, American leftists who, feel that Israelis are, have put up purposeful blinders, I think that it's important to recognize that this sort of collective trauma of that period just before Bibi was elected, and then again in 2000, which was that people felt that they couldn't go to the mall, they couldn't get a cup of coffee, they couldn't go to a club. And granted, these are, you might argue, a Palestinian family doesn't have enough food and doesn't have enough water and doesn't have any work, and these things are larger issues than whether or not you can get a cup of coffee. But the problem is that it's not about setting up an equal, either or. But during this period of successful, and I'm putting that in air quotes, terrorism, where they were terrorized, they became more and more divorced from the idea of wanting peace process for the sake of both sides. And they became more and more interested, understandably, I think, as much as we regret to say so, understandably more invested in just living a normal life and not caring about what happens to the people on the other side, because they felt completely divorced from the idea of any kind of Palestinian self-determination, let alone security on their side. All they wanted to do was set up a scenario where their families could go about their daily lives and they could stop thinking on, how many Americans think, as you were saying, how many Americans think day to day about, the importance of certain, geopolitical strategic ideas or peace or, these major themes? I think most Israelis wanted the Ben-Gurion, a nation like, all others, which meant, unfortunately, in this case, it means creating a horrific security scenario with a second set of laws just, 40 minutes away from their homes. It's just easier to shut down about that.
I think what the Israeli left would say to that is that, this is part of the problem. It's its own form of decadence.
Of course.
And I mean, where do you draw the line between, not having decadence and having bombs coming in, having rockets come into Tel Aviv? But like at the same time, I actually, this weekend I had the privilege to meet with Ami Ayalon, who runs a group called Blue White Future, which you're probably aware of. And, because I'm going to be in Israel next month, might do something on them. Blue White Future's whole thing is preparing the grounds. They call it right now, friendly unilateralism. It's sort of laying the groundwork for essentially a repeat of what was done in Gaza, which was Israel unilaterally withdrawing without a deal with the other side.
Right.
That's pretty much a political non-starter in Israel right now because of the Gaza experience, which was widely interpreted as a massive failure because Israel withdrew, then Hamas took over, then rockets started coming, and if you do that on the West Bank, then the rockets reach places not like Sderot, but Tel Aviv. What Ayalon, who is a just a classic, really a figure out of an Israeli superhero comic book. He was head of the Navy. He was in Shaitel at 13, the elite commando group. He was the head of Shin Bet, Israel's domestic intelligence agency. He said that after he got out of public life, he went into business and was uncomfortable with how much money he was making because of his socialist backgrounds, and so decided to donate most of it. I mean, it's really, comic book, heroic Israeli leftist socialist, And what he said about, the obvious question to ask anyone who advocates unilateral withdrawal from the West Bank is, what about Gaza? Why won't that happen again? He essentially said, well, first, he has reasons why it won't. We'll leave the IDF in, which we didn't do in Gaza. We're not withdrawing everyone all at once. It's more about, it's still gradual, so it's different, he'll say. But he'll also say, look, there will probably be rockets. And he said, this is the quote he said to me. He said, I'm not offering security. I'm offering identity. In other words, we'll be fighting for something again. We'll be fighting for Zionism. We'll be fighting, that's actually what Israel's supposed to be, is it's larger than just a conglomeration of people living in one place in peace. It is an idea.
Right.
And that might be a hard sell, but that's a sort of classic, Israeli left argument on that, which I don't know, maybe it could resonate, but I think to resonate, it would almost require this current peace, you know, relative peace among, you know, Tel Avivians, for example, to sort of be threatened a little bit more.
Right, but then you have this extreme, I didn't mean to cut you off, but, you know, and you also have this more extreme left position, which is, you know, the people of 972, who I wrote about for The Nation a couple weeks ago, you know, and this idea that people are promoting of a, you know, that the two-state solution is already dead, that there is no two-state solution, that there will never be a true two states, and so therefore there should be a one state, which is, of course, anathema to, you know, many Jews globally, and certainly a number of Jews internal to Israel, because of the idea of, you know, the inherent tension, and this is our sort of the Hebrew school, you know, debate. Can there be a Jewish state that's a democratic state, a truly democratic state? Is there such a thing? Is it a state with a true religious identity that's also truly democratic? And the question of whether or not this process is, you know, it's not just about a unilateral withdrawal, because, you know, we've created facts on the ground in the West Bank that make life untenable, and that we're, you know, there are too many, you know, leaving the IDF, all those kind of caveats create a scenario where you're not actually allowing a true state to exist, and then what happens to the Palestinians? And I think that that's that these sort of fractures along the side of the reinvigorated left, you know, now that sort of the left was dead, long live the left, now created these kind of major philosophical questions that I think that become very difficult for Jews outside the United States outside of Israel, let alone everyone else outside of Israel to engage in and understand why they create these fissures in this major way. I mean, what do these issues mean? I mean, I find that in the United States, you know, liberals, you know, sort of, you know, understandably kind of chafe at the idea of why does Israel need to be Jewish? Why does it have to be a Jewish state? You know, even though our politicians, you know, pay, you know, homage or lip service to that idea all the time, there will always be a Jewish state, it's the gathering of exiles, the post-Holocaust, blah, blah. But in fact, you know, that idea has become contentious in certainly in Europe, and then in certain more left circles in the United States, although here it's more fringe. In Europe, it's much more mainstream. And I think that we have this becomes this question right now, you know, about what does that future look like? Is it really two states? Is it not two states? I mean, you even have, you know, Haaretz columnists like Carlos Strenger arguing the two states are dead. We've lost that opportunity. And it's really interesting. I feel like the conversation in Israel is much more vibrant and engaged. And I mean, of course it is, it's them, but at the same time, we seem to speak in sort of cartoonish, you know, big statements that don't necessarily connect. Like I believe in, and you know, we can use this as our segue into the next part, or we can kind of mingle them. You know, the United States has created a kind of mythical Israel in our political conversations, you know, that it's not necessarily connected to what's happening at all. You know, we have this sort of cartoonish picture, you know, of what the state is and what the political ramifications are, and what these, you know, what Israelis want and what's politically palatable to an American population versus an Israeli population versus a global population. I don't know if that's a question for you, but if that makes sense.
What exactly is the question?
So, I mean, you know, going towards this direction of, you know, what does it mean? How do we present Israel in terms of its political relationship to the United States and in our own? I mean, as we were saying, you know, the peace process can't advance during an election year in the United States with Americans as brokers, right? I mean,
right.
And some of the Israeli lefties want the Europeans to step in, which is, They sort of aren't. I think Catherine Ashton.
I mean, I certainly think we need a new. The International Crisis Group came out with a report on the peace process about 2 weeks ago called, obviously, The Emperor Has No Clothes or something to that effect, mm-hmm. about a naked emperor, because that's what the peace process is. And one of the things they call for is a new broker. I mean, the broker is not the United States, the broker is the quartet. But the quartet is the United States. And that's sort of this weird, dishonest thing. You know, one thing the ICG called for was a sort of new sort of international broker to do this. Not that I know exactly what that would be or where Israel would move. I mean, opponents of the U.S. being the broker say that, you know, say all the obvious things. You know, how can you have an honest broker who's very clearly weighted on one side? Whereas supporters would say, you know, Israel is the side with more power right now. And just pragmatically, what that means is that to get the side with more power to make concessions,
right,
which is what we're talking about, then you need the broker to be actually on their side and having their back. If the broker were neutral, then there would be no, there would be much less incentive for the more powerful side to make concessions, which is what we ultimately want. In terms of, I mean, the other thing here, I mean, that is sort of the subtext of even this very conversation is the, I think, this the feeling of impotence among American Jews, particularly American Jewish liberals, over, like, well, what can we do? And there are, I mean, you know, is it how much is this our fight? How much is this not our fight? I mean, we don't vote in Israeli elections. We say we support Israel, but also have specific ideas for what Israel should do. But part of supporting Israel turns out to be supporting Israel. I mean, it's simpler sometimes than it sounds. But the problem is, what do you do when, you know, the Israeli voters vote in coalitions, and coalitions are formed that are right wing and are, you know, not jiving with our values? What do we do? I mean, there are proposals. I mean, obviously one of them is our various boycotts, which is something that we can do, but it's not, you know, in addition to ideological issues, some, including myself, I'd have with those, it's not really that effective. Right. It's not really going to get anything done. I don't think. And I mean, I think a large part of this conversation, and I guess, like, as a liberal American Jew, I mean, we're in the rather enviable position of being journalists with platforms to write about this, who arguably can do ever so slightly more than the average American Jew. But what would you tell, like, an average liberal American Jew who supports Israel, supports Zionism, wants a two-state solution, wants Israel to remain Jewish and democratic, et cetera, et cetera, but who doesn't really, you know, sees what we see, which is that this peace process is, you know, neither peace nor process. What would you tell? What would your advice be to a liberal American Jew who wants to make a difference, as it were, and actually have some effect on the world, as Jews, by the way, are taught is in fact their obligation?
Right. I mean, well, I think it's interesting. It's a great question. You know, Noam Shezoff, who's the editor of 972, said to me he feels that American liberal Jews have sold out liberal Israeli Jews, that we allow a certain kind of liberalism for our own lives, and we structure our lives and our relationship to the United States differently than we do around what we think of liberalism for Israel. And I think that that's something we all have to think about, which is that true? I mean, do we have two sets of liberalisms? You know, is there something that, you know, does Israel get a bit of more of a pass than we'd give the United States on issues of race or immigration or equal opportunity or equal rights or certainly peace? And I think that this is... the big question is around, I think, about uniformity of opinion, and this gets into this question of the Jewish vote, perhaps, you know, which is there a uniformity of opinion on what the process should look like and what the relationship to Israel is, and is the relationship of Israel, and this is, it seems so obvious, I mean, certainly to us, but I don't think it always is, which is, you know, does the United States, when Obama speaks at the Holocaust Museum, as he did a couple weeks ago, and I was there, and it was incredibly moving, and I thought, gee, if only all Jewish voters were here to hear him and recognize that he does kind of get it. You know, he kind of gets the Jewish essential, you know, trauma, and he understands the community in ways that I think he's often been accused of not getting. You know, he really related to the survivors who were there, and he met with each of them afterwards, and he, you know, he spoke really movingly about how them not giving up gives us all, you know, the purpose to go forward. And it was well linked to this genocide prevention board that was just created in ways that didn't diminish the Holocaust and yet use it as a, you know, model by which we have to hold up the rest of our, you know, law is the future, our future, the future of our children. But, you know, I think that there is something about this idea of, it's one thing to relate backwards towards the Holocaust, and it's one thing to relate backwards towards, you know, past traumas, and it's another thing to look forward and think about whether or not there has to be a kind of essential, you know, a support of all things the Israeli government does. And I, you know, it's the AIPAC J Street conversation to some degree, which is, you know, support for Israel does not necessarily mean a support for Likud blanketly, or a support for even a coalition government blanketly, or a support for everything Israel does blanketly, that we can say that we don't need to be condescended to. And I sometimes do think that the ways in which our politicians speak about Israel becomes a kind of condescending blanket conversation around, you know, universal support for Israel. We always stand with Israel. I mean, maybe that is essential in some ways to the rest of the population, but I do think that there needs to be some sort of caveat within that not everything, and I don't want to sound, you know, that I'm parroting Peter Beinart or something, but I think that there is something about that support for Israel.
That took, we got 40 minutes. We got 40 minutes before his name came up. I think we can congratulate ourselves.
Right. I was trying to go the whole hour.
I wasn't going to be the first.
Right.
Now that you've done that. No, but I mean,
now that it's out.
He is the reason his book resonated is because he seemed to speak for the impotency of the rural American Jews who feel that their politicians, possibly excepting Barack Obama and a few others, aren't speaking to them. I think you're completely right to cite them, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, so...
No, it's fair. Look, I mean, it's becoming, you know, and I actually think that Peter's a really interesting example insofar as, despite his, you know, obviously, you know, he's a beautiful debater, but I, you know, in his op-ed in the Times a couple weeks ago, I was really struck by it, and it ended up being a conversation just among friends, that he felt that he had to sort of put out, you know, his own bona fides. I'm an Orthodox Jew. My kids go to Heschel. I observe, my children observe, I am a Jew. I mean, and it's an interesting thing where I think it becomes, you know, this test in some ways that you have to sort of constantly prove yourself. And I feel it in for myself as well. I mean, you know, I wrote a piece a few months back about anti-Semitism and, you know, got all kinds of hate mail. And I had this desire to sort of say, wait, you know, you don't know me, I've lived this very Jewish life. I mean, the fact that you feel that you have to somehow prove yourself in that way, you know, that, oh, my daughter has an Israeli name, and I went to Camp Ramah, and I've been in Israel 50 times, and I lived there, it's an interesting question about the relationship to the state. You know, obviously Jews, on both sides of the spectrum feel ownership of the state in some way. And we've come to a moment where ownership means many different things. And obviously it means different things to Israelis as well. And often that sense of ownership by American Jews sort of comes into conflict with what Israelis believe about their own country on both sides of their spectrum. And I think that we've reached this strange moment in, you know, Jewish peoplehood, if I can say that. I guess that's for me, I feel condescended to often, but you're right. I mean, we have a soapbox and we read and, you know, we relate to it more sort of viscerally, perhaps, because we have to think about it all the time. But I guess that's the question. And that gets into this question of the endless kind of hand wringing over the Jewish vote. And what does it mean that, you know, so much anti Obama super PAC money has come from like big Jewish donors? You know, are we trending in a different direction or not? Or, you know, are these fissures things that are, you know, how much is about Israel policy? How much is about economics policies? You know, are Jews still liberals, basically?
Well, the polls are pretty unmistakable. Jews care much more in terms of prioritizing. They care much more about domestic issues than Israel or Iran. So while, you know, they are much more rightward on Iran than their voting on, say, Iran or on the peace process, then their voting record would suggest that's because of their priorities. And mm-hmm. it's because something like 93% of them, I think it was, are pro-choice, for example. I remember speaking to doesn't matter who, but a semi-prominent Republican Jew before the AIPAC conference this past year. And I said, you know, are you going to be there? Am I going to see you there? And he said, why would I go to a room with 13,000 Democrats in it? Because, I mean, and that's AIPAC. Mm-hmm. That's the AIPAC conference he's talking about.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the problem. I think in terms of why there's all this hand-wringing about the Jewish vote, I think there's a couple of reasons why. One is because there are certain, you know, organizations who, I mean, on both the left and the right, on both Democrats and Republican side, who are dedicated to the Jews and the Jewish vote. I think secondarily, I've often wondered if Jews are seen to some extent as validators for Israel. It's sort of, I mean, Israel is something the whole country cares about. It's not just Jews, and for good reason. And Israel is wildly popular in this country. But I think the suggestion might be that non-Jews might take their cues to some extent from Jewish voters when it comes to Israel, you know, the same way, I don't know, if there was something going on in California, you would ask a Californian. But the problem is it's not exact because American Jews are not Israelis. They're American Jews, which is the strange moment thing you're talking about. And I don't know if the strange moment started recently or less recently. But, yeah, I mean, I think there's a real disconnect in terms of American Jews may feel they no longer – some American Jews may feel they no longer so completely need Israel and may not feel such a connection to it, which is, I mean, the data sort of point both ways. There's data that shows that the younger generation of American Jews feels less connected to Israel. There's also data that shows that younger generations always feel less connected to Israel and that they actually grow into their connection to Israel. And, you know, actually, Peter Beinart's original essay in the New York Review of Books 2 years ago leaned very heavily on data and on the argument that younger Jews are becoming less connected. In his book, he actually backs away from much of that because there is actually very persuasive data that it's really just young Jews are less connected to Israel, whether it's 2012 or 1982. But in terms of hand-wringing over the Jewish vote, I do think we're going to see that again this cycle. Mitt Romney, you know, has, you know, I think pretty good Jewish support for a Republican. I think, to your question, are Jews still liberals? Overwhelmingly, Jews are still liberals. I mean, on the economy, on social issues, on the environment. I mean, it's overwhelming. I think like something like 70 or 80% support gay marriage, and this was before Obama's announcement. I mean, which is that's gigantic.
I think it's something like 82%. I looked it up.
That said, there is the divide between traditionally Orthodox Jews and other Jews, and they tend to be much more conservative, and they are growing as a percentage of the population because they have higher birth rates, much like in Israel.
Right. I mean, I think what's interesting is that, you know, you get into that, and then we don't have that much more time, but, you know, obviously, you know, those social issues, you know, something like 93% of Jews polled favor abortion rights and 81% favor same-sex marriage. And again, obviously, we're not talking about the ultra-Orthodox or maybe even Orthodox. And then you get into the same questions around Israel as well. I mean, obviously, a lot of liberal American Jews have had an easier time debating kind of the social justice questions internal to Israel itself, you know, questions on, you know, women at the back of the bus or economic disparity among Jews or within Israel proper. I think those questions, you know, are much more easily debated because they're on the same kind of lines that we kind of discuss our own country. And that's an easier conversation to have, you know, religious pluralism or something like that. No, I mean, I agree. There were some statistics showing that the Jews are becoming slightly less economically liberal, and that, you know, that there's a debate between a divide or emerging divide between economic policy and social issues. But still, I mean, overwhelmingly compared to any other.
I mean, the famous line, the famous, you know, cliche which was said, I think, 60 years ago, is that, you know, Jews are the only group that earn like Episcopalians and vote like Puerto Ricans. And
right, yeah.
I think that's largely true, and I'm not sure why. I'm sorry?
I was going to say it, but I didn't want to say it.
No, don't worry. So I was the one who did it the thing. I'm not sure why that would change, just because if it were going to, I don't see why it wouldn't have already. This has been true for 60 years, if not longer. In fact, if anything, the less well-off Jews are probably the traditionally Orthodox Jews who vote Republican, arguably, against their economic interests more frequently. We saw this, for example, for the race to replace Anthony Weiner, where the Republican won despite facing a Jew in heavily Jewish district, because the Jews there were Russian immigrants and, you know, traditionally Orthodox Jews who vote more right-wing.
Right.
So I'd be interested to see if, I mean, certainly if Jews do, that would be the way. If I were a Republican strategist who wanted to secure more of the Jewish vote, I wouldn't do it by Israel, because it's not a big enough priority for Jews. Once there's a baseline, I mean, this is why some of the right literally try to completely discredit Obama on Israel, like 100%. You know, they say he delegitimizes Israel. I mean, Lynn Cheney said this at AIPAC. You know, no president has done more to delegitimize Israel. Because the reason they're saying that is because if he does anything better than not delegitimize, if he does anything better than delegitimize Israel, then the threshold is crossed and most American Jewish voters go on to these other issues where they vote overwhelmingly Democratic. So that was, if I were a Republican strategist trying to get Jews to vote Democratic, I mean, trying to get Jews to vote Republican, I would make an appeal to their economic interests and you know, make the same appeals I make to other people, you know, about how, you know, this is better for the economy, this is better for you, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't see too much sign of that happening. In terms of this election, Obama's not going to get as much of the Jewish vote as he got last time, because he's also not going to get as much of the American vote as he got last time.
I mean,
we can go inside baseball and talk numbers if you like, but I mean, it's not going to be, he's not going to get a Carter-level low amount of support, and he's also not going to get the amount of support he got in 2008, and it's going to be somewhere in between, and both sides will declare victory afterwards, and maybe it will be telling, probably it won't be. I think probably it'll just be mostly the same.
All right. Well, I think we have to wrap up, and I think we can go on and on about this, I think, for another hour or two. But thank you so much. This has been Sarah Wildman for Sarah Posner on The Posner Show with Mark Tracy of Tablet Magazine, and hope to see you again soon. Thanks for chatting, Mark.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for chatting.